And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is June the 9th, 160th day of the year. 205 days remain until this year is over with. 441 BC, the Athenian coup succeeds, forms a short-lived oligarchy. AD 53, Nero, the Roman Emperor, marries Claudia Octavia. AD 68, Nero commits suicide, which I'm assured has nothing to do with him marrying Claudia Octavia. He quotes Virgil's Aeneid, thus ending the Julio-Claudian dynasty and starting the civil war that became known as the Year of the Four Emperors. 721 AD, Odo of Aquitaine defeats the Moors in the Battle of Toulouse. 747, Abbasid Revolution. Abu Muslim Khorasani begins an open revolt against the Umayyad rule, which is carried out under the sign of the Black Standard. 1311, Duccio's Maiesta, a seminal artwork of the early Italian Renaissance, is unveiled, installed in Siena Cathedral in Siena, Italy. 1523, the Parisian Faculty of Theology finds Simon de Colonnes for publishing the biblical commentary, Commentari Initiatori in Equator, Evangelia by Jacques Levy d'Etaples. That's a mouthful. 1534, Jacques Cartier is the first European to describe a map of St. Lawrence River. 1667, Second Anglo-Dutch War. The raid on the Medway by the Dutch fleet begins. Lasts for 5 days and results in the worst ever defeat of the Royal Navy. 1732, James Oglethorpe is granted a royal charter for the colony of the future state of Georgia. 1772, the British schooner Gaspee is burned in Narragansett Bay, Rhode Island. 1798, Irish Rebellion of 1798. The battles of Arklow and St. Field take place. 1815, end of the Congress of Vienna. The new European political situation is set and underway. 1856, 500 Mormons leave Iowa City, Iowa, on what's called the Mormon Trail. 1862, American Civil War. Stonewall Jackson concludes his successful Shenandoah Valley campaign. He has a victory in the Battle of Port Republic. His tactics during the campaign are now studied by militaries around the world. Had he not been shot by his own men, the war could well have had a different outcome. 1863, American Civil War. Battle of Brandy Station in Virginia. 1885, Treaty of Tientsin is signed to end the Sino-French War. China eventually gives up Tonkin and Annam, most of present-day Vietnam, to France. 1900, Indian nationalist Bisiramunda dies of cholera in a British prison. 1915, William Jennings Bryan resigns as Woodrow Wilson's Secretary of State. There's a disagreement regarding the U.S. handling of the sinking of the Lusitania. 1922, Alland's Regional Assembly convened for its first plenary session in Mariehamn, Ireland. Today, that day is celebrated as Self-Government Day of Ireland. All right. Moving right ahead. 1923, Bulgaria's military takes over the government in a coup. 1928, Charles Kingsford Smith completes the first trans-Pacific flight in a Fokker trimotor monoplane. That plane was known as the Southern Cross. 1930, Chicago Tribune reporter Jake Lingle is killed during the rush hour at Illinois Central train station by Leo Vincent Brothers. Allegedly, he was killed over a $100,000 gambling debt owed to Al Capone, of all people. Now, I wonder if you kill the person that owes you money, how you going to get paid? But that's just me. 1944, World War II. 91 civilians are hung from lampposts and balconies by German troops in Thule, France, in reprisal for Marquisard attacks. Also in 1944, Soviet Union invades East Karelia and the previously Finnish part of Karelia, occupied by Finland since 1941. 1948, foundation of the International Council on Archives under the auspices of UNESCO. 1953, the Flint-Worcester tornado outbreak sequence kills 94 people in Massachusetts. 1954, Joseph Welch, special counsel for the U.S. Army, lashes out at Senator Joseph McCarthy during the Army-McCarthy hearings, giving McCarthy the famous rebuke, "You've done enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last? Have you left no sense of decency?" 1957, the first ascent of Broad Peak by Fritz Wintersteller, Marcus Smuck, Kurt Diemberger, and Hermann Boole. 1959, USS George Washington is launched, the first nuclear-powered ballistic missile submarine. 1965, the civilian prime minister of South Vietnam, Phan Huy Quat, resigns after being able to work with a junta led by Nguyen Cao Ky. 1965, Vietnam War. Viet Cong commences combat with the Army of the Republic of Vietnam in the Battle of Dong Hoi, one of the largest battles in the war. 1967, 6 Days War. Israel captures the Golan Heights in Syria. 1968, President Lyndon M. King Johnson declares a national day of mourning following the assassination of Senator Robert F. Kennedy. He hated Robert Kennedy with an unbridled passion. In fact, there is a story that Robert Kennedy went on an overseas trip following up a lead to the killing of his brother John. When he came back, he went to the White House, went into the Oval Office, and proceeded to beat the bejesus out of Johnson. Secret Service had to pull him off. No one ever said what the fight was about. 1972, severe rainfall causes a dam in the Black Hills of South Dakota to burst, creates a flood that kills 238 people and causes $160 million in damage in 1972 dollars. 1973, in horse racing, Secretariat wins the U.S. Triple Crown. 1978, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints opens its priesthood to all worthy men, ending a 148-year-old policy of excluding black men from being priest. 1979, the ghost train fire at Luna Park in Sydney, Australia, kills 7. 1999, the Kosovo War. Federal Republic of Yugoslavia and NATO signed a peace treaty. 2008, two bombs explode at a train station near Algiers in Algeria, kills at least 13. 2009, an explosion kills 17 and injures more than 46 at a hotel in Peshawar, Pakistan. And in 2010, at least 40 people are killed, more than 70 wounded in a suicide bombing at a wedding party in Arghandab in Kandahar. Folks take that stuff so seriously. All right, a lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Far too many to go into. However, holidays and observances. Anniversary of the accession of King Abdullah II in Jordan. Autonomy Day in Islands. Christian Feast Day. Aidan of Lindisfarne in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Beatty in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Columba. Ephraim the Syrian in the Roman Catholic Church and Church of England. Jose de Aceta. Primus and Felician. Coral Triangle Day, La Rioja Day in La Rioja, Mercia Day in Mercia, and in Uganda we have National Heroes Day. All right, let's see what else we may have, if anything. Okay. British Conservative Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, as a result of the victory in the Falklands, and as a result of divisions within the opposition Labor Party, had a landslide re-election victory to a second term in this office, to the office of Prime Minister in 1983. Okay. In 1549, the Book of Common Prayer is adopted by the Church of England. 1977, the Silver Jubilee of Queen Elizabeth II of Great Britain. 1997, the British lease on the new territories in Hong Kong expires. 2019, 1 million people protest in Hong Kong over proposed new extradition laws to China. That was one of the largest ever protests in that city. 1934, on this date, was the first appearance of Donald Duck in a cartoon called The Wise Little Hen. And of course, if you're into the blues, in 1924, on this date, the Jelly Roll Blues is recorded by jazz pioneer, pianist, and composer Jerry Jelly Roll Morton. Okay, let's see what else we may have. It's Donald Duck Day, National Earl Day, National Strawberry Rhubarb Pie Day, World APS Day, Writers' Rights Day. It's America the Beautiful Week, Bed Bug Awareness Week, and if you have them, you know it, Canadian Environment Week, Community Health Improvement Week, End Mountaintop Removal Week, Healthcare Executives Appreciation Week, International Clothesline Week. Don't see many of those anymore. National Automotive Service Professional Week, otherwise known as a mechanic. National Body Piercing Week. National Business Ethical Week. National Commuter Challenge. National Fishing and Boating Week. National Fragrancer Week. National Garden Week. National Headache Awareness Week, and if you got a headache, you know it. National Lemonade Week, Pet Appreciation Week, Prepare Tomorrow's Parents Week, a month rather, Shampoo Week, and Teacher Thank You Week. Alrighty. Let's see what else we might have. Okay, 1957, four Austrian climbers become the first to conquer Broad Peak, the highest mountains on the border of Pakistan and China. 1946, Bhumibol Adulyadej is crowned king of Thailand. And at his death on October 13, 2016, he was the world's longest reigning head of state. He had been on the throne for 70 years. 1963, Johnny Depp was born. 1961, Michael Fox. Also in 61, Aaron Sorkin. 1915, Les Paul and his band of renown. He co-designed the Gibson guitar. Now, in this 2013, on this date, Ian Banks died, Scottish author. 2011, M.F. Hussain died, Indian painter and director. In 1870, Charles Dickens died. Well, maybe he just quit moving. Okie dokie. Alright, birth dates, June 9th. Peter the Great is actually the most famous person born on June 9th. Zodiac sign is Gemini. Chinese zodiac sign is the rat. Now, let's see. The second most famous person was Leopold I, Holy Roman Emperor. Then we have Johnny Depp, Robert McNamara. I knew his daughter-in-law, crazy as a loon. George Stevenson, Wenceslao IV Vasa, Eric Hobsbawm. Lothair II, Holy Roman Emperor, born in 1075. Okay. We will continue. Oh, this is also National Sex Day. Let's not forget that. In 1064, Coimbra in Portugal fell to Ferdinand, the King of Castile. 1790, John Barry copyrighted the Philadelphia Spelling Book, first American book to be copyrighted. Also in 1790, Civil War broke out in Martinique. In 1860, the Miss Anne Stevens book, Valeska, the Indian Wife of the White Hunter, was offered for sale for just 10 cents, which even in 1860 was an amount of money you thought about before you spent. It was the first published dime novel. 1861, Mary Ann, also known as Mother Bickerdyke, begins working in Union hospitals. 1931, Robert Goddard patented a rocket-fueled aircraft design. 1940, Norway surrendered to the Nazis. 1943, the withholding tax on payrolls was first authorized by Congress. You know, the original income tax, which was levied during World War I, was a temporary measure that was only going to be used till the war was over. But the government saw so much money rolling in, they kept it going. 1945, Japanese Premier Kentaro Suzuki declared Japan would fight to the last rather than accept unconditional surrender. 1946, Mel Ott, manager of the New York Giants, becomes the first manager to be ejected from a doubleheader. He was ejected from both games. 1965, Michel Jazzy ran the mile in 3 minutes, 53.6 seconds. He broke the record set by Peter Snell in 1964. 1980, on this date, Richard Pryor, severely burned by a freebase mixture that exploded. He was hospitalized for more than 2 months. 1985, Thomas Sutherland, an American educator, was kidnapped in Lebanon. What he's doing in Lebanon is anybody's guess. He wasn't released until November 1991. 1986, the Rogers Commission. You can always count on government to come up with a commission. Released a report on the Challenger disaster. According to that report, the spacecraft blew up as a result of a failure in a solid rocket booster joint. If it wasn't that, they'd have found something else. In the year 2000, Canada and the U.S. signed a border security agreement. This agreement called for the establishment of a border enforcement team. In 2000, U.S. House of Representatives voted to repeal gift and estate taxes. The bill called for the taxes to be phased out over 10 years. But I've never seen a Democrat that didn't love a tax. In 2011, the world's first artificial organ transplant was performed. It was an artificial windpipe coated with stem cells. Alrighty. Well, we're going to go from history back to what we've been talking about, which is the assassinations of the Kennedy brothers. The interesting thing is, there is a story that Ted was told if he ran, he'd be next. Now, keep in mind, we've got a Marine Corps marksman who is not a marksman at all, who made an impossible shot in an impossible amount of time, and then he was killed by a man who, with a gun, walked into the basement of the most heavily guarded facility in Dallas and shot the most heavily guarded prisoner. So the two people who could have told us what actually took place in regard to John Kennedy were both either dead or dying. It's extremely unlikely that an operation so daring and requiring so much skill, organization, advanced planning, would have been carried out by the lone nut gunman described in the Warren Report. And, of course, what all the mainstream media expects us to believe. And even if it had been a lone nut gunman that did it, Oswald was not the sharpest knife in the drawer by any means. Now, he'd already tried and failed to assassinate another public figure. But let's look at the evidence that says he didn't do it and couldn't have done it. Yes, there is evidence to that effect. And it's considered quite conclusive. The Warren Report, of course, covered it up. There was a Ms. Geraldine Reed, who was an employee at School Book Depository at the time of the assassination. She died in July of 2020. But before she died, she made a statement to the effect that she was flown to Washington in 1964 to give evidence to the Warren Commission. In their brilliantly written report, the commission called her Mrs. Robert Reed. Seems there were two Reeds that worked at the School Book Depository at that point in time. And the commission did not want anybody to go behind them and investigate what they did. So this evidence that she presented was so devastating and conclusively contradictory to the Warren Commission findings that it was suppressed. She told the commission that about a minute before the shooting, she was in her office on the second floor of the building. Lee Oswald walked in and asked her for change for a dollar bill so he could buy a can of Coke from the dispensing machine outside that office. She gave him the change, and as they talked, they both heard the first shots of the assassination outside. Now, they didn't know there were gunshots. You don't hear that very often in downtown Dallas. And a few minutes later, a police officer, Officer Marion Baker, burst in and found Oswald sitting there quietly drinking his can of Coca-Cola. Now, this would have been a cast-iron alibi for Oswald if he'd ever been brought to court and charged with the murder of Kennedy. But, of course, he never got the chance to go to court because he was murdered by Jack Ruby. Now, at the time, the presidential motorcade was running late, and JFK was due to arrive at his destination, the Dallas Trade Mart, about 12:15. But he made a couple of unscheduled stops earlier on to speak with crowds of well-wishers. So it was about 12:30 by the time he was driven past the book depository on the corner of Houston and Elm Streets. Now, if I were an assassin waiting for the motorcade to pass so I could shoot the president, I'd make sure I was in position very early. But at the time when the motorcade was due to pass the building, Oswald was on the second floor drinking a Coca-Cola. Now, not surprisingly, the two police officers confirmed in evidence that Oswald appeared to them to be relaxed and enjoying his Coke when they first saw him, just over a minute after the first shots were fired. Now, according to Arlen Specter, Oswald fired the shots and dashed down the stairs, bought a Coke, and sat there quietly enjoying it. Now, if he'd actually had done the shooting, he'd have to race up the stairs to the sixth floor, get there just as the president's motorcade was passing, fire the shots, hide the rifle, where it could later be found, and race all the way back down to the second floor again. And then within seconds, appears as if he didn't have a care in the world, not even be out of breath. Now, another discrepancy in this mountain of problems that had come up with the Warren Commission report was the rifle allegedly used by Oswald, a Carenco Mannlicher, was it a Mauser? All the police officers who first arrived at the sniper's nest, while Oswald supposed to have fired the shots, were adamant the rifle they found was a Mauser. The deputy sheriff, who was an award-winning police officer and a gun expert, claimed he saw the word Mauser even stamped on the barrel. Later documents and affidavits referred to it as a Mauser that had a telescopic sight. And frankly, a Mauser is a very popular sniper's weapon. But the gun at the crime lab, later on received for testing, was a Mannlicher Carenco, or Carcano, rather. According to the FBI report on the rifle, the telescopic sight has no reference to the rifle's line of fire and couldn't be adjusted to the rifle without what's called a shim. And there were no shims anywhere to be found. Couldn't even be test fired without being worked on by an expert gunsmith. And it was found to be inaccurate beyond a range of about 15 yards. So they clearly it could not be the weapon used in the assassination. So you have to ask yourself why the Warren Commission was adamant that the rifle Oswald used was this Carcano. Well, there's evidence that they said it because of the existence of the photograph taken earlier in 1963 that purported to show Oswald in his backyard holding that rifle. The insinuation by the showing of that photo was that this was the same rifle he used to kill the president. Now, during the House Committee on Assassination investigation in 1978, CIA officials testified that the agency owned in November 1963 12 6.5 Mannlicher Carcano rifles and a million or so rounds of matching ammunition. Why would the CIA own a rifle that even when it was new was described as a piece of crap? Even the photograph of Oswald holding that rifle appears to have been tampered with. If you make a Google image search for Oswald Carcano, you'll see the photograph that allegedly shows Oswald holding that rifle standing in the backyard. But if you look at that photograph carefully, you'll see his head is too large for his body. It's possible it's a photo of somebody else with Oswald's head superimposed on him. And not only that, but the angle in which he's standing is physically impossible to maintain for more than a fraction of a second. His head is way over the line of his right foot, so he had been hopelessly unbalanced. So at the end of the day, it's very clear that that photograph was actually a forgery. There's another interesting point about that rifle. Oswald acquired the rifle by ordering it through the mail. So he had to give his name and home address. And he paid by way of a money order, which would have involved a further danger. Witnesses at the outlet where he bought the money order might have recall that fact. So why didn't he just walk into a gun store and buy a rifle and pay cash? And he wasn't short of cash in the months before the assassination, according to a number of witnesses who knew him. I mean, at that point in time, no registration would have been necessary, and he could have been completely anonymous. Now, he did apparently go to a Dallas gun shop to mount a scope on the rifle. So why didn't he buy the rifle there as well? And Oswald knew all about rifles, one of his favorite subjects, according to work colleagues at the New Orleans parking garage where he once worked. And if he was really going to carry out an assassination in the way he was supposed to have done it, would he have bought a 6.5 Italian Man Liquor Carcano rifle for that purpose or use an easily obtained Mauser? Now, the Carcano is a bolt-action rifle. It can only, with great skill and difficulty, be made to fire 3 accurate shots in 5 seconds, as he supposedly did on November 22nd. Now, his only experience of firing semi-automatic rifles during his time in the Marine Corps was in 1959. There was no evidence he ever fired a rifle after that, although he was in the Soviet Union for 3 years. If he really intended to kill the president, he would have known their requirements, and he would have bought a rifle that was able to deliver him, not a poor-quality, aged, inferior rifle he allegedly equipped himself with on that very day. Now, the number of shots fired in the assassination doesn't matter as far as the subject matter goes. But another relevant point in Oswald's favor is that at least 3 shots were fired in the space of 5 seconds. Subsequent acoustic evidence suggests the number of shots would have been significantly more. It's barely possible to fire 3 shots in 5 seconds from a Carcano. Oswald's supposed to have done that and hit his target twice, something experienced marksmen have tried to do in similar circumstances and failed unanimously. Now, the confusion as to which rifle was used to fire the bullet would alone be sufficient to acquit Oswald of trial for the murder of President Kennedy, so they had to make sure he didn't go to trial. Now, for this plot to have been carried out, you need, one, a superb marksman who, with a high-powered rifle and telescopic lens, could be relied on to hit his moving target at anything up to a couple of 100 yards. And, number 2, a means to divert the attention of the police while he got away. In any event, it was a highly organized operation, probably involving the building of a replica of all the relevant buildings, the landscape, and the highway system centered on Dealey Plaza so he could practice. Now, a likely location would be somewhere in the Mexican mountains where a large area could have been leased from the Mexican government, who could have then provided troops to seal it off from prying eyes under the pretext of a commercial or research experiment venture. So that brings us full circle to the question of whether Oswald was part of the team of assassins with the lonely role of simply wasting police time in the immediate aftermath of the shooting and putting him off the scent of the real killer, or whether he was completely innocent of any part of the assassination. Clearly, he was not the shooter. Timeline doesn't work out. But when we look at Oswald's agenda for the couple of months preceding November 22nd, it's highly unlikely he would have been found time to slip across the border to Mexico for some training at a secret location. Now, it's said by some commentators he did travel to Mexico City September 27th in order to apply for a visa at the Cuban embassy to visit Cuba, and he didn't return to Dallas till October 2nd. However, the Cubans declined his application, and he had to spend considerable time with the embassy to argue his case. So there wouldn't have been any time for him to attend a training camp of any kind. And photographs of the so-called Oswald in Mexico City were not Lee Oswald. On the other hand, maybe it wasn't necessary for Oswald to take part in all the rehearsals, as his role was to be a comparatively minor one and not complicated at all. But the other participants could all have been on site where the whole operation could be rehearsed over and over until everything ran like clockwork. Now, for this plot to succeed, there had to be cooperation at a high level. How were the Secret Service agents, for example, forced to stand down from the president's car? For most of the motorcade through Dallas, President Kennedy was afforded the usual protection by the Secret Service. This involved having Secret Service men jogging alongside the rear of the car on each side. Before the procession turned into Dealey Plaza, though, Secret Service men were ordered away from the president's car, you know, to the following car. There are YouTube videos that have made the rounds that clearly showed the president would have been the agent who would have been closest to the president, displaying incredulity and anger, being ordered to abandon his charge. Whoever gave the order was in the line of command that led right back up to the so-called elite. Now, it's true, Kennedy had given instructions that he should not be overprotected by the Secret Service. He wanted to come across to the people of Dallas in a positive way. But he had this kind of protection right up until that very moment. And it hadn't been a problem. Now, that action, which of pulling the agents away, meant that the snipers firing from several points would have had an unimpeded trajectory. In other words, they had a clear aim at President Kennedy's head. Now, in order to carry something out like this, you need a number of personnel, a master marksman, the actual assassin, an assistant to the master marksman, a decoy sniper, a second decoy, and getaway drivers for all of these folks and any others that might have been involved. And he needed access to the chosen building for the decoys to operate from, and that was the Texas Book Depository. And this was done by arranging for Oswald, who has been referred to as the second decoy, to get a job working at the depository. And he carried out this part of the plan on his return from Mexico City, and he commenced work on October 16th. On the day of the president's visit, most businesses along the motorcade route gave their staff extra time off so they could watch from the windows or got into the streets to see the president go by. And while most of the staff at the book depository did leave the building to watch the motorcade, Oswald stayed behind. And toward 12:30 that afternoon, he just went up one floor to the second floor, bought a Coke from the automated machine, and sat down and calmly started to drink it. Now, early in that day, another assassin armed with a military M16 or similar weapon hid himself beneath the cover and overflow drain in Dealey Plaza, in the road itself. Now, this was an ideal position from which to fire at the president at very close range if one of the earlier bullets failed to reach the target. Or maybe he would have fired anyway just to make sure the president was dead. Previous gunfire would provide cover for the noise of a shot and the confusion nobody would ever think of anybody be firing from underneath the drain cover. In addition, there was a clear escape route down the drain to where it drained into the Trinity River. And a man with a gun was sighted near that river immediately after the assassination. So in good time, the actual intended assassin and his assistant arrived at their selected place, just behind a fence at the top of the grassy knoll adjoining Dealey Plaza. The assistant took out and assembled a high-powered rifle with telescopic lenses and gave it to the assassin. Now, interestingly enough, they had chosen that spot wisely. There were no members of the public as it wasn't the best place to stand and watch the motorcade. And there's plenty of space closer to the road where you can get a much better view. So as the presidential car approached the spot where all concerned knew the shooting was going to start, the actual assassin raised the rifle into position and focused on the president's head. On the sixth floor of the depository, the decoy sniper actually fired the first shot, and he missed. And that may not have been a signal for the real shooting to start, or it may have. His second shot hit Kennedy in the back, exited through his neck, just below his larynx. A third one hit Governor Connally, who was sitting directly in front of Kennedy, caused substantial, though not fatal, damage. Now, the intended assassin fired at that point and had to deliberately miss the president's head. And the reason for that was that Kennedy, having been hit by the second shot, moved much closer to Jackie, who was sitting to his left. And it was too much risk that she would have been hit in the head, which was not intended. So within a fraction of a second, the actual assassin, hiding beneath the drain cover, fired. The president was hit in the head fatally. Few people noticed the sounds of the shot from the grassy knoll of the overflow drain. All attention was on the depository where the first three shots came from, which was exactly how the plan was supposed to play out. It's possible Jackie heard the shot from the drain, and that may be why she crawled onto the rear of the limo in order to peer down into the drain. Secret Service man Clint Hill, whose job was to protect Jackie, jumped on the back of the vehicle and helped her back into the rear seat where she'd be safe as possible in the circumstances. Immediately after firing the shot, the intended assassin tossed his rifle to his assistant, was on his way to meet his getaway car. Similarly, the decoy sniper was making his way down the back stairs of the depository. Or maybe he used the fire exit stairs to rear the building. He left the car in Kano, or maybe it was a Mauser rifle in a corner, be bound to be found. There were no fingerprints on it, so he must have worn gloves. Behind the grassy knoll, the intended assassin's assistant quickly disassembled the rifle and put it back into a tool case before walking briskly away to where his own getaway car would be parked. Now, the final piece of the puzzle here relates to the three tramps who were arrested by police near the grassy knoll and then released. Photographic evidence suggests they may have included Howard Hunt, who became famous 10 years later in regard to Watergate, and Frank Sturgis, both of whom were CIA marksmen, and may have been carrying fake Secret Service ID. The only person not approaching a getaway car was Oswald. His job was to be intercepted by the police whenever they stormed the building looking for the assassin, and that is exactly what happened. Vital minutes were wasted while Oswald calmly answered questions and denied he fired any shots. And this was true. He was telling the absolute truth. And that went along with his relaxed manner on the second floor, four floors below where the shots were said to have been fired. Other officers ran up to the fifth and sixth floors and found that rifle. There being no apparent reason to arrest Oswald, police let him go, get on with his job. But by this time, his job was actually ended. Time for him to wander away to his pickup point. Only problem was his car wasn't there, and that's where the plan went wrong. Well, he panicked and went to another possible rendezvous. Whether he waited for a while, we'll probably never know. All we do know is he eventually caught a taxi to his lodging on the outskirts of town and left shortly after that, where he allegedly wound up shooting Officer Tippett, and then having allegedly shot two people, went to the movies. Well, there's one more thing to concern ourselves with. For years there have been stories of how President Kennedy's neck and head injuries were interfered with, first at the Parkland Hospital in Dallas and second at the autopsy held at the Bethesda Naval Hospital in Maryland, which is where his body was taken following the flight back from Dallas. Some people have suggested that the wound just below his larynx was in fact an entry wound, not an exit wound. And this injury was used by the medics at Parkland to make a tracheotomy. That's a standard procedure to try and enable breathing to resume if the upper airways are blocked. Now, it doesn't appear from all evidence that in doing this there was any intent by them to deceive anybody as to the nature of the injury. The medics at Parkland, I'm sure, knew as soon as they saw the extent of Kennedy's injuries there was no hope for him to survive it. But they had to follow standard procedure. And there was absolutely no reason for them to commit any irregularities, suggest otherwise, be to imply that the conspiracy extended to the staff who happened to be on duty at Parkland at the time, which is somewhat improbable, I would have to say. But there is one aspect that deserves attention. The autopsy should have been held in Dallas. This was a state matter, and there was no authority to remove the president's body from Texas. But it was removed in time to be with the main parties. They flew back to D.C. on Air Force One a couple of hours later. According to some folks, the Parkland authorities refused to give up their jurisdiction. The body was actually taken at gunpoint by the Secret Service. Now, one possible reason for this is that a proper autopsy revealed the fatal wound to the head was caused by a bullet coming from the front, not the rear. And this would, of course, destroy the lone gunman explanation that was part of the official story. In the event, it seems that certain alterations to evidence were made at Bethesda, and it has to be asked whether this was so the official version of the fatal bullet having entered from the rear could be maintained, and therefore the lone gunman theory would continue to play out. So, if this account of how the assassination and the subsequent cover-up were carried out is anywhere close to correct, then everything else falls into place. It does show how the global elite can carry out whatever crime they like with impunity and then organize a gigantic cover-up whenever they have to. And it also shows that Lee Oswald is only a small part of the conspiracy. Now, Lyndon I Want to Be King Johnson had a burning ambition to become president, and frankly, he saw himself as the rightful holder of that office. This attitude was in spite of the fact Kennedy had done so well in the 1960 primary and won the Democratic Party nomination outright in the first round. Kennedy was also extremely intelligent, far smarter than Johnson. Had charisma, was a natural in front of the TV camera, was witty, charming, with a great sense of humor, was an excellent communicator and debater, was able to win waivers over, had youth on his side, and he was clearly a visionary. Now, Johnson had none of these attributes. He wasn't particularly smart. He was not charismatic by any sense of the word. Had a weird desire to humiliate and bully any of his enemies. And he was awkward in front of the TV cameras. Didn't have any wit, didn't have any charm, had a warped sense of humor. He required, for example, male guests at the White House swimming pool to join him in walking around the place naked. Looked like an old man, even though he was in his early 50s. Couldn't communicate easily. Never had an original idea in his life. But he was conceited enough to believe he could easily replace Kennedy as president. For example, it was Kennedy who first envisioned the America Space Program. Made a speech in the open air at Rice University, September 12, 1962. In that speech, he announced his administration's intention to put a man on the moon and bring him back safely to Earth before the end of the 60s. And a number of other things. Not because they're easy, but because they're hard to do, he said. That was an historic occasion, and many famous and influential luminaries were present, including Vice President Johnson. And if you view the video recorded of Kennedy's speech, it's notable everybody's attentive to what the president's saying. Except Johnson, who's sitting just a few feet away wearing sunglasses and looking like a bored schoolboy. If Kennedy and his inner circle treated the vice president with some degree of indifference, maybe Johnson's general attitude toward the president and his administration had something to do with it. Another initiative which Kennedy had profound and beneficial implications for the world was his private correspondence with Nikita Khrushchev. Those culminated in the signing of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty of 1963. It's recently become quite common for researchers that Kennedy's assassination suggests that he was murdered on the orders of Vice President Johnson, or that Johnson was somehow the mastermind behind the killing. Now, it is known that Johnson had the access to the services of thugs and hitmen, and he used those services from time to time. And since Johnson's death in 1973, there's a lot of evidence that's come to light suggesting he was behind at least 20 or so murders involving his Texas business dealings, spread over several years to include the years in which he was vice president. And frankly, he was one of the main beneficiaries of Kennedy's murder. He became president as a result. That was something he almost certainly would never have accomplished alone. But all the evidence and research of years suggest a conspiracy involved people and bodies much higher up the power grid than Johnson. Among those were the Mossad, the Israeli Intelligence Service, the CIA, the FBI, the Secret Service, the Mafia. Now, Johnson was familiar with leading players in most of those organizations. I mean, he was well acquainted with J. Edgar Hoover. Envisioning the whole enterprise would have been beyond Johnson's rather limited capability. But there's no question he had to be in on the plot. The look he gave JFK at the Hotel Texas event on the morning of November 22nd says it all. He couldn't wait for him to be shot. Johnson's longtime mistress, Madeline Duncan Brown, recalled in an interview that Johnson told her the night before he wasn't going to have to put up with any more humiliation at the hands of the Kennedys. And he hinted that something big would be happening the next day. Well, some commentators have alleged that shortly before the motorcade entered the Dealey Plaza, it stopped so Johnson and his wife could transfer from the same car as Kennedy and his wife and were in to another car, two cars back in the motorcade. Now, that story has made the rounds for years, but it doesn't appear to be true. The motorcade was organized at the airport where the plane carrying the president and his party landed, and there doesn't seem to be any evidence that it stopped or people switched cars before it got to Dealey Plaza, but It does seem reasonable for the president and the VP to travel in separate cars in a motorcade. I mean, there's always the possibility of an attack. So as to ensure as far as possible whatever may happen, both aren't killed or seriously injured at once. They normally carry and travel in separate cars, but Johnson's actions right before the assassination show that he knew something was going to happen. Another allegation against Johnson has been that just before the shooting in Dealey Plaza, he crouched down in his car anticipating an attack, which proved that he knew something was going to happen. Now, he was traveling in the same car as Senator Yarborough, and the two of them hated each other. So if Johnson did anything like that, then Yarborough may well have told people about it afterwards. But there doesn't seem to be any evidence that the senator ever said anything about it. So in summary, Johnson actually hated the Kennedys with a passion, and he desperately wanted the presidency for himself. And he would have paid any price for it, up to and including murder. But you have to ask yourself, was he the one giving the orders? Now, all the evidence seems to support the fact that Johnson was well aware of what was going to happen, and he was apparently a party to the conspiracy for almost as long as it existed. But he wasn't the man that got it started by a long shot. So, let's look at some other reasons for the murdering of President Kennedy. July 1963, Kennedy wrote the following letter to the Prime Minister of Israel. His name was Eshkol. Gives me great pleasure to extend congratulations to you as you assume responsibilities as Prime Minister of Israel. You have our friendship and best wishes in your new task, and it's on one of these that I'm writing at this time. You're aware, I'm sure, of the exchange I had with Prime Minister Ben-Gurion concerning Americans' visit to Israel's nuclear facility, Dimona. Most recently, the Prime Minister wrote to me on May 27th. His words reflected a most intense personal consideration of a problem I know it is not easy for your government, as it's not for mine. We welcome the former Prime Minister's strong reaffirmation that Dimona will be devoted exclusively to peaceful purposes and reaffirmation of Israel's willingness to permit periodic visits to Dimona. I regret having to add to your burdens so soon after your assumption of office, but I feel the crucial importance of this problem necessitates my taking up with you at this early date certain further considerations. Now, not many people knew at that point in time that Israel had the bomb, but they did. Now, this letter that Kennedy wrote, in effect, threw down the gauntlet to the Israeli government. And he said very clearly, this government's commitment to and support of Israel could be seriously jeopardized if it should be thought we were unable to obtain reliable information on a subject as vital to the peace as the question of Israel's efforts in a nuclear field. Now, even though he used diplomatic language, Kennedy was actually threatening to cut off the huge financial military support of Israel, without which that country would probably collapse. Now, at that point in time, in 1963, Israel had only been established 15 years. In that time, it had driven the native Palestinians out of a huge area of what up to that point had been their country for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. It's also been in a state of conflict with its immediate neighbors for much of those 15 years. In short, the whole area had been unstable since the establishment of the State of Israel. And, frankly, it still is. Soviet Union had been arming and backing several Arab opponents of Israel, such as Egypt, to counter what they saw as unwelcome U.S. influence in the area. Now, this is a simplified view, but essentially that's how things were in the Middle East. Now, in spite of all the test ban treaties, Israel was busy developing its own nuclear capability at the moment. Now, the Israeli government insisted they were merely developing nuclear energy for purely peaceful purposes. But everybody in both the Israeli and U.S. governments knew that was a lie. So Kennedy was applying pressure on Israelis to open up their Dimona facility to inspection with the purpose of forcing them to abandon nuclear weapons. Now, in 1963, of course, JFK was probably a little naive in his views of how he could handle Israel. He thought it was simply a matter of bringing the Israeli government into line with other countries. Further pressure from the Kennedy administration included restricting the amount of military hardware supplied to Israel, limiting financial aid. What Kennedy failed to realize was that a lot of the folks involved in this program in Israel regarded themselves as being above any international law. It was used to apply pressure, not to receive it. Now, interestingly enough, some of Johnson's biggest supporters came out of Israel. Not because they liked Johnson, but because they didn't like Kennedy. After Kennedy's death, Johnson eased the pressure on Israel by turning a blind eye both to Israeli interference in U.S. politics through campaign contributions and to the ongoing goings-on at Dimona. Let's not forget Pollard, who was caught spying for Israel against the U.S. So you have to ask yourself, could Israel have been behind the murder of President Kennedy? Ex-Israeli spy Mordecai Vanunu says that Israel is behind the assassination. I don't tend to think Israel by itself would have done it. By the late summer of 63, it was already known the likely Republican candidate in the 64 election would be Barry Goldwater. Some commentators have said Goldwater was Jewish, but actually only his father was Jewish. His mother came from an old Yankee family, as he was called. And he did little or nothing to connect himself with a Jewish identity. But he did identify as a staunch patriot and enemy of both communism and what was often referred to as the Eastern financial establishment. So, would Goldwater have been better for Israel than Kennedy? Now, Kennedy would probably have easily beaten Goldwater in the 64 election if he had survived. And one of the many strange things about the aftermath of November 22nd is that the Mossad, already a massive and powerful secret service, was never investigated or even asked any questions about its activities around the time of the JFK assassination. It's likely the Israeli intelligence service, as in the case of the 9/11 38 years later, at least knew in advance what was planned and didn't pass on their knowledge to those who could have taken steps to stop it from happening. Then, we have another issue that's come to light. Executive Order 11110, signed by President Kennedy June 4th, 1963. It was an amendment to Executive Order Number 10289 relating to the performance of certain functions affecting the Department of the Treasury. Put simply, Executive Order 11110 enabled the Secretary of Treasury to issue silver certificates against silver held by the Treasury and not already held for the purposes of redeeming any other liability. It's been claimed by some this order didn't take any powers away from the Fed, and even that Kennedy intended to strengthen the Fed's powers over the U.S. economy. But the problem is we don't know what Kennedy's intentions were. There was some speculation Kennedy had actually stumbled on the enormous fraud that's at the heart of the U.S. banking system, and no doubt after consultation with his brother Robert decided to tackle it head on. We're going to talk more about that in the next show, but for now, we run out of time. This is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.